And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's topical occurrence. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on this Wednesday edition. We had a little technical glitch and played the wrong intro to this program. But instead, this hour, we learn the story of ex-FBI agent and CIA consultant Robert Levinson. He's the longest-held captive in American history, even eclipsing the time spent by Mideast captive Terry Anderson after his abduction in Beirut in 1985.
Bob Levinson was 58 years old when seized in Iran in 2007. He has a large extended family, many living in the Broward County city of Coral Springs. They're still working hard for his release, or at least for word of his condition.
We learn more about this saga from award-winning New York Times reporter Barry Meyer. He's written the book Missing Man, The American Spy Who Vanished in Iran.
And he joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome to you, Barry Meyer.
Thanks very much for having me on.
It's great to have you. I think one of the most remarkable things, or the first remarkable thing about this story, is how much attention it has not received, how long it was covered up, how little's known about his case, the case of Robert Levinson, how few people even know his name, at least until your book. Would you just comment on that?
You know, it is rather remarkable, and even the people who think they know the story actually don't know the story. They may know the bare outlines of the story, which are simply this. You know, Bob Levinson, a former FBI agent turned CIA consultant, disappeared on an Iranian island in March of 2007. He supposedly, according to the United States government, was there working for a tobacco company investigating counterfeit cigarette trafficking. In fact, he was a CIA consultant, and he had gone there to try to recruit a fugitive American assassin to be a spy agency source inside Iran.
Did you believe the story that first emerged about him?
I did for a couple of months. You know, I stumbled over this very early in late 2007. You know, as a reporter, you're always hunting around for stories. And I picked up a newspaper, and I saw an article about a missing FBI agent, the fact that he'd gone to this Iranian island called Kish to meet a fugitive American murderer. And I was fascinated. Here was like this, you know, mystery story. And I'm a big fan of, you know, espionage and mystery stories. But when I started calling around to people that investigated cigarette smuggling, they all sort of laughed and said, this is ridiculous. We'd never send, you know, a big former FBI agent with a Jewish last name to Iran. We'd send a local in who spoke Farsi, who would blend in. So that started the trail that in a couple of months led me to the Levinson family, their lawyer, and journalist, and eventually to get possession of Bob's files and emails, which began to tell the real story.
So tell us more about the CIA part of this mission.
Well, the CIA, Bob became a consultant to the CIA in 2006. You know, as an FBI agent, his specialty was Russian organized crime, Colombian drug cartels, the mafia. He had a very long career spanning 23 years, and so, you know, the type of crimes he investigated changed as the crime world did. But by the time he got to the CIA, he was a private investigator. He was brought in by a woman who was an analyst at the CIA. And at that point in time, what the CIA was very focused on, this was 2006, was Iran. It was an area that Bob didn't know very much about. And he felt that, you know, if he was going to keep this part-time job, or better yet, expand it into more of a full-time job, he'd better get up to speed very quick. And he took this extraordinary risk to do so.
Before we get to Ann Jablonski and him being hired, let me ask you that now. Was he hired by the CIA? Was he a contractor? Was he a consultant? What was his status exactly?
He was a part-time contractor. Essentially, he wasn't technically an employee. That is to say, okay. He didn't get health benefits from the CIA. He didn't have a pension from the CIA. But the CIA uses a lot of consultants. And so he had a contract that was funded for a specific amount of money. And basically, that contract was enforced so long as there was money in his account. When he came to the agency, you know, he started generating a lot of reports, but fairly soon on, at least from the documents that I've reviewed, they made it clear to him that they had a real interest in Iran. Just to be clear also, there's nothing that I've stumbled across from a documentary standpoint to show that, you know, the CIA ordered him to go to Iran or even knew that he was going to Iran beforehand. But they were well aware that he was collecting information about Iran in potentially dangerous places like Istanbul, Dubai, and elsewhere. So there was a stockpile of information that he was collecting for the CIA about Iran.
I'm sure his family has heard this question many times. Why would someone who's pushing 60, just purchased a new home in Coral Springs in Broward County, the father of seven, take on a mission of this stature, of this amount of danger?
Well, it's the question, it's a good question. It's actually the question that informed my own thinking when I began to research his story and get sort of obsessed with it myself. You know, Bob was a complex person. On the one hand, he was, you know, a patriot. He was someone who had worked for the government for more than two decades and wanted to be part of the government again. He had a large family. He needed money. And he also, you know, was a risk taker. His going to Kish wasn't the first time he had taken risks. He had taken many risks in his career before. I mean, this was a risk of a really extraordinary nature. And I can't read into his mind, but I can sense from reading a lot of his correspondence and his reports that it was his feeling that if he could just land this source in Iran, or at least let people know that he had made this attempt to do so, that it was going to pay off for him in terms of getting more work from the CIA.
Well, let's go back a little. So his friend, the CIA analyst Ann Jablonsky, or Toots, I guess, as he called her, he knew her from dealing with the Russian gangs and mobsters when he was with the FBI, correct?
That's absolutely correct. She, like he, was a specialist in Russian organized crime. It's an area that they both got obsessed with. She from the CIA perspective, he from the FBI perspective. They met each other for the first time in 1992 at a Justice Department conference for, you know, agents and prosecutors specializing in Russian organized crime, and stayed close to each other. They, you know, Ann Jablonsky and her husband would send the Levinson family Christmas cards every year, and one of Bob's daughters came up to Washington, spent a day with Ann when she was up there. So, you know, there was this friendship that went back, you know, 15 years. And I think there was a lot of warm feelings, professional feelings. And when Bob was looking around for work, Ann also had a need. You know, there was a lot of money around after 9/11 to hire consultants, and she saw the opportunity to bring someone into the analytical group in which she was working who had the skills of an investigator.
Well, it just seems strange to me. I'm puzzled by the fact that he had no background or familiarity with Iran or the Middle East. He didn't have the language skills. Wouldn't you think that the CIA would want to hire someone who did possess the knowledge about the area they were being hired for?
Well, you would think that. But one of the sort of eye-opening things that struck me as I researched the book was how poorly the CIA functions. I mean, we spend a huge amount of money, you know, basically throwing it down a tube for intelligence and information that really has little value and could, in fact, you know, and where people are risking their lives or risking their safety to gather that information. It's not like the CIA is operating at a high level and is only getting very high quality intelligence. There was an instance in the book where there's some guy who's gotten a stolen telephone directory from Venezuela showing how they're monitoring dissidents in their country, and he's trying to peddle it to the CIA. So there's this big gray market intelligence world where people are selling information, stuff that may have no validity to it, But the CIA is still an eager buyer of it.
Okay, so he's hired for this special group called the Illicit Finance Group within the CIA, correct?
Right. Just so your readers understand who aren't totally familiar with the CIA, I'm sorry, your listeners, CIA has two parts. One is the analytical part, and these are basically desk jockeys who get reports and information, compile it into reports that go to policymakers, and then there's the clandestine side, the spies, who go out and develop sources abroad and develop informants abroad. And these two sides, while they're supposed to operate collaboratively with each other, there's a very bright line that is supposed to separate them. And that line is that people on the analytical side, people like Andrew Blonsky, are not supposed to send people out on covert missions or even send people out overseas to gather information because it could endanger an actual operation overseas.
What was Ann Jablonsky's position in the Illicit Finance Group? Did she have a position in that group?
Yeah, she was a senior analyst.
Okay.
Yes, within the Illicit Finance Group. She had more than, when this Bob comes there in 2006, Ann has more than 20 years under her belt at the CIA. She's a very valued analyst. She's been promoted into a special senior rank of analysts that's intended to keep people, working as analysts rather than having to promote them up the food chain to become managers. So she's highly respected for her expertise in Russian crime. But this group is made up of lots of people. There are people who are interested in money laundering. There are people interested in foreign political corruption. There are people who have specialty interests in particular parts of the world, be it Russia or Iran or North Korea. So it's kind of a hodgepodge. And the information they're getting is being filtered through both to the people on the clandestine side, if they think it's of value to them, as well as in reports to policymakers.
We're going to take a short break on today's Topical Currents. We're speaking of the story of Robert Levinson, who's been held somewhere, if he's still alive, since 2007, probably in Iran, with Barry Meyer. He's an award-winning journalist and author. He's a staff reporter for the New York Times. He's written Missing Man, the American Spy Who Vanished in Iran. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're speaking with reporter Barry Meyer, New York Times award-winning reporter Barry Meyer, about his book, Missing Man, the American Spy Who Vanished in Iran. Barry, take us up to once Levinson gets to the area and what ensues.
He goes there to meet an individual by the name of Dawood Salahuddin, whose actual name is Teddy Belfield. He's a fellow that grew up here in the U.S. on Long Island, and in 1980, he assassinated a former aide to the Shah of Iran, flees to Iran, and has been there ever since. Since going to Iran, Salahuddin has expressed a lot of displeasure with the Iranian government. It hasn't turned out to be quite the paradise he thought it was going to be when he murdered in the name of the Islamic Revolution. And so people have gotten the idea that somehow maybe he's willing to become an informant, maybe he's willing to come back and trade whatever knowledge he has for a reduced sentence for this crime. And so through an intermediary, a retired journalist, Bob sets up a meeting with him on this Iranian island, Kish, and they meet in March of 2007. And Salahuddin is the last person to see Bob. I mean, all we know factually is Bob boarded a plane in Dubai. He flies to Kish. He checks in to this hotel. When his wife goes there almost a year later, she is shown a ledger showing his signature checking out the following day. But whether that signature was coerced what happened to him at the hotel, what happened to him on the way to the airport, we don't know. We just do know that he never got on a plane leaving Kiev. He's not on any passenger manifest.
We don't know for a fact that he met Daoud Salahuddin, right? I mean, we don't know that for sure.
Well, there were sort of eyewitness accounts of the meeting that took place. There were hotel officials who subsequently said they saw Salahuddin there, they saw Bob there, they saw them meet there, yes.
Did the U.S., getting back to him for a minute, who it's hard to believe anything because you say he is a sociopath, but once he committed this assassination and left for Iran, did anything happen? Did the U.S. ever attempt to apprehend him? What happened there?
Yes, they tried basically to trick him to come out of Iran. You know, he's a very vain individual, and he loves speaking about, you know, how brave he was to commit this murder on an unarmed person. All kinds of things, and, you know, basically spins these tales about these heroic deeds he did while he was in Iran. And, you know, essentially there was one policeman from Washington who struck up a friendship with him and tried to lure him out of Iran so he could be arrested. But essentially the Iranians have given him safe haven. I mean, I have no idea what they think of him, why they want him there. But certainly from their perspective, you know, why would they want to do anything for the United States by turning him over? So essentially he has a safe haven.
Could you tell us more about Ira Silverman and his relationship with Salahuddin?
Sure. So Ira Silverman was a longtime producer of investigative reports for NBC News. He worked with Brian Ross, who's still on the air with ABC News. And in the 1990s, he got to know this detective in Washington by the name of Carl Schaffler, who was one of the detectives who arrested the Watergate burglars. And it was Carl Schaffler who believed that Salahuddin might have value to the U.S. And Ira and Carl Schaffler were close friends. They talked about this a lot. After Schaffler died, his family gave Ira his tape recordings that he made of Salahuddin, and Ira became convinced that Salahuddin could be of value. Fast forward a couple of years, Ira also has a close relationship to Bob. Bob is a source for him on stories that he's doing for the news. They're close personal friends.
Okay.
So when Bob starts expressing interest in, you know, telling him about his new CIA job and expressing interest about Iran, Ira basically says, well, you know, I have got a perfect guy for you.
It's such an amazing thing that he would want to meet with an assassin, a radical, someone
Islamic,
and that he didn't even have the sanction or the order from the CIA that you know of to do that. Are there suspicions that Salahuddin could have murdered him or at least was involved in setting him up?
It's certainly the latter. I mean, I think there's two schools of thought. One is that Salahuddin set him up and knew beforehand and was complicit in it. The second one is that because Salahuddin is known for sort of running at the mouth, that he is monitored very closely by Iranian intelligence. You know, Iranian intelligence monitors everybody in that country, their emails, their telephone calls. And there's a lot of email correspondence going on between Salahuddin and Ira Silverman, who is acting as the go-between. So I think, you know, even if he did not do it overtly, certainly it would not be surprising to me to learn that the Iranian intelligence apparatus either knew Bob was coming or once they saw him come, they were able to quickly get a sense of why he was coming there.
It's pretty amazing, though, that Ira Silverman, who himself was a journalist, knows that he has this email exchange with Salahuddin and obviously has to know that nothing's private in Iran, and that he would still think it was okay for Bob Levinson to go over there and meet with him.
Ira Silverman, I think, was under the impression that Bob's mission to Iran was sanctioned by the CIA.
Ah.
Bob was very circumspect about who he told about what he was doing. And I think in speaking with Ira, I certainly came away with the impression that Ira believed that this was green-lighted by the CIA. Certainly, Ira believed that after Bob disappeared, and there's no reason to think he changed his mind about that. Mm-hmm. What makes the story so powerful in my mind is, and hopefully for the reader as well, is that there are people who, you know, everyone in the story is kind of operating on these assumptions and these beliefs and these thoughts, and they're really, many of them are not true, or they're mistaken, or they're creating stuff out of whole cloth. And it's this constellation of forces and factors that contribute to this tragedy.
Who and when was it realized that he was missing?
Well, Ira Silverman was expecting to get a phone call from Bob as soon as he left Iran. You know, he was only supposed to be there overnight. And so when he doesn't get that phone call, a day or two later, he calls Christine Levinson, Bob's wife, who is unaware that Bob's gone to Iran, to find out, well, have you heard from him? And she says, no, haven't heard from him. And for her, it was extremely unusual, because on the day that Ira calls her, it's Bob's 59th birthday. Right. And although he's traveling, there's this expectation that he's going to call home so the kids who are still young enough and are living at home can wish him happy birthday. And then, boom, it sort of, everyone realizes that he's missing, he's gone, and things sort of take off from there.
You know, we're going to talk about the cover-up and all that because it's so important, but generally, when someone is apprehended or hostage or made captive, it's announced and celebrated and someone takes credit for it. Did that ever happen?
That never happened. I mean, it never happened in a way where there was an individual or an entity or a group taking credit for Bob's capture. Even the videotape that was released in 2010, there's no one claiming responsibility. There's no specific demand being made that's attributable to a group or a government or what have you. And it really does speak. The question you're asking is a very profound one and a good one in the sense that, you know, while on the one hand you could say, why isn't that happening? One possible explanation for that is that this was a very well-done, highly skilled counterintelligence operation by some segment of the Iranian intelligence community, because they made it, they masked everything, they hid everything. They made things appear one way when they weren't another way. And I think it's reasonable to assume that, initially at least, they thought that Bob Levinson was a big catch, that he was a real big spy. And that was compounded when the U.S. government did nothing to try to rescue him in the months after his disappearance.
Well, that's what we're going to get to after this short break. We're speaking with award-winning journalist, New York Times journalist, Barry Meyer, about his book Missing Man, the American Spy Who Vanished in Iran. We'll be right back.
And we're back with today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and New York Times reporter Barry Meyer. We're talking about his book, Missing Man, the American Spy Who Vanished in Iran. Of course, that's written about Bob Levinson, whose extended family, many of them still live in Broward County in the city of Coral Gables. Coral Springs, I'm sorry. If you have a comment or question, that's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576. Email radio@wlrn.org.
So, Barry, nothing was really done. Okay, we got to the point that he called his wife, and it was very unusual. or that he didn't, that Ira Silverman called Bob Levinson's wife. And okay, now what happened after they realized he was missing?
So they sound the alarm, and the FBI hears about it. And the FBI contacts the CIA and says, what goes on? You know, we're being told that he went over there on a CIA mission. He was a CIA consultant. And there's a total denial from the CIA, both from the operational, the spy side, but also from the analytical side where Bob has his contract. They're basically saying, you know what, his contract has expired. He never did anything related to Iran. We don't know anything about it. And the FBI, you know, is not, you know, doesn't like go gangbusters after this. They kind of hand it off to what appears to be some relatively inexperienced agents who sort of plod along and don't handle the case very aggressively or not ordered to handle the case very aggressively. I mean, one of the things that I found shocking is that when I sort of get involved, which is approximately about 9 months after Bob's disappearance, I have his emails, I have his documents, I start seeing, well, here's who he went to see in the weeks before he went to Kish. There's some Iranian people here in Canada or wherever. And I start calling individuals, and none of them have been contacted at that point by the CIA. And I checked that by the FBI. There are people who are Bob's friends, private investigators, former FBI agents, who are telling me that they're calling the agency, and the agency is basically blowing them off, saying, you know, keep your nose out of this. Don't get involved. And, you know, I think the book charts both the cover-up at the CIA that took place as well as the incompetent handling of this investigation in the first year or so, which any investigator will tell you is the absolute critical time to try to resolve a kidnapping or a hostage case.
Do you think that their cover-up of this case is largely responsible for the fact that, and at the time that they did it, as you say, the first year is so crucial, that is responsible for his still being either held captive or being dead?
I think that, you know, I don't know if I can speculate on that question specifically, but I will say that had this case been handled differently, aggressively from the get-go, it could have had a very different outcome. And if he is no longer with us, he might be even back home by now. I think one of the great tragedies of this story is that what it clearly demonstrates is that we are willing to abandon people, even abandon people who have spent their careers working as servants, as employees of this government. And if it doesn't fit in with the needs of the moment or the policy demands of the moment, they essentially become, you know, roadkill on the way to some greater goal.
Why do you think the cover-up, the CIA covered this up? They lied to his family. They lied to Congress. And I would like to talk about the fact of there being not many consequences to that, too. But and to the FBI about their ties to him. Why? What would be the motivation for this?
Well, as banal as it may sound, and as troubling as it is, there are many people in this world, including many of them that apparently work at the CIA, who are more concerned about their careers than about the life of an individual. And it's a tragedy. And there are individuals there who made choices. And they're certainly not choices that I would agree with, and I hope that if I was in a similar situation, those are not the choices that I would personally make.
Tell us about the first pictures of Bob Levinson after his capture.
The first pictures were this videotape that came out in late 2010. It wasn't released publicly until about a year later. But in that videotape, Bob looks completely different than he did. You know, Bob was kind of very overweight, big guy, with a mustache, and in this videotape, it looks like he's lost 100 pounds. He's sitting in a prison cell. His shirt is torn and frayed. He looks like he hasn't shaved for a few days. And he is literally pleading for help from the United States. It's a very powerful, dramatic tape. You know, it's heart-wrenching looking at it. I've seen it, you know, dozens of times. Then there's another group of photographs that emerge, and your listeners may have seen these published. They're the ones showing him in an orange jumpsuit with a wild kind of look in his eye and a big bushy beard, and he's holding up these signs that say, you know, why aren't you helping me? Why have you abandoned me? And he's dressed in an orange jumpsuit like a Guantanamo prisoner. And it's not clear, the FBI was not able to determine whether those photographs were actually made before the videotape was taken or after the videotape was taken. They were received by the family about 6 months after the videotape was made, but it's not clear the date of their creation. But those were the only, you know, what would be called, you know, proof of life type information that's ever been sent about Pop.
Well, let's talk about the fact that the CIA lied to Congress. Were there consequences and disciplinary actions taken for the within the CIA?
Yes, there were, but they really resulted just in there were three individuals, Anne and two other senior
analysts. Ann Jablonsky.
Correct. Ann Jablonsky and two other senior analysts who were forced out of the agency. The agency claimed to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, which has oversight for the CIA, that it had, you know, changed its rules or regulations. I firmly believe that there were many people within the CIA who, if they did not know about Bob's journey to Kish before he went, became aware of it afterwards, within the weeks and months afterwards. And there may be people in significantly higher levels now of the CIA who were part of that cover-up. And to me, one of the obligations that Congress has to the Levinson family, given their this tragic situation they find themselves in, is to find out the truth, to find out who, you know, abandoned Bob, who lied to Congress, who was part of this cover-up. And unfortunately, no one in Congress and even lawmakers from your own state who you'd think would have an interest in this have been willing to step up to the plate.
And they've been contacted?
Contacted by
I mean,
me,
by the Levinson family?
I mean, the facts are out there. I mean, the facts speak for themselves. All of them have my book. All of them have read stories in the New York Times and elsewhere. You know, it is abundantly clear that there are people within the CIA, besides those people who were pushed out, that learned about Bob's trip to Iran in the weeks and months afterwards. And it is still, you know, it was 6 months later that the CIA was still lying to Congress. Mm. And to me, it's appalling that people who were involved in those lies are still collecting a government paycheck.
Tell us about Bob Levinson's oldest son, Dan Levinson, and that he considered going to Kish and has worked tirelessly for his father's release and even has considered a political career in Florida.
Yeah, Dan is, you know, Bob and Chris raised seven children. And one of the great pleasures for me of working first on the story and then working on the book was getting to know some of them. They're great, all of them. The ones I've known, which are about five of the seven kids, are terrific. This was a great family. They are a great family. This is a family where there's tremendous amount of love. There are no real sibling rivalries. And, you know, Dan, as the oldest son, took it upon himself to be sort of the child that was going to go out and be a public voice for the family, to find out as much as he could about his dad's disappearance. He loved his dad. He admired him. Dan actually did go to Kish probably about 2 or 3 months ago in the hope of finding out something about his dad, something that would be helpful. And, you know, they've done everything this government has asked them to do. You know, for many years, Chris and her kids lied publicly because they knew that's what was best for Bob. You know, they concealed his relationship with the CIA because they were told by the government that that might be the most helpful thing to do to get him back. Unfortunately, I don't think the government has reciprocated in terms of doing everything it can do to try to bring this chapter to a close.
You know, you speculate on them, on the Iranians, if they are the ones that seized him, thinking that he was this big player and they were getting somebody very important. Well, he obviously wasn't. So who do you think was or is still holding him, if he's still alive, and what were or are their motives now?
I think that in time, their motives became a way of basically, one, taking a stick and poking an eye in of the U.S. and saying, okay, you want to send somebody over here to do this kind of stuff? This is what we're going to do to you in return. And as long as you don't admit to what he was doing here, even if he was doing it on his own, we're going to keep doing it to you. And if you're going to pretend that you don't spy on us, we'll do it some more to you. So he became kind of a weapon, both to use to antagonize the U.S. and to try to collect data, you know, sort of throw out these crumbs and clues to try to get information about how the U.S. spies in Iran. As to what, you know, and as to which component or segment of the Iranian intelligence or religious hierarchy had control of him over time, I don't know the answer to that question. As you probably are aware, Iran is a very fragmented country. There's these sort of parallel structures that exist within Iran, and they don't necessarily talk to each other. They may compete with each other. But there's no doubt in my mind. There is no one who would have the motives or the opportunity or the interest to keep an individual alive for that long under the conditions that Bob Levinson was kept alive. I mean, if there were cigarette smugglers or Russian criminals or whomever, they would have killed him in the first month or traded him for money. So the only logical explanation here is that he was perceived as having some political intelligence value and was used as a pawn in that regard.
We're speaking with award-winning journalist Barry Meyer about his book, Missing Man, the American Spy Who Vanished in Iran. It's the story of Robert Levinson. Our last break, and we'll be back.
And we're back with today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and New York Times reporter Barry Meyer. We're telling the story of Bob Levinson. Barry tells that story in his book, Missing Man, the American Spy Who Vanished in Iran. Our number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. Also, email is available. In fact, Bonnie, you have an
emailer. John wants to know. He said he found the passage about former FBI agent Mark Rossini, who was working for the FBI media at the time of Levinson's disappearance, interesting. Is there more to that part of the story?
It's sort of a complex aspect to the story, but Mark Rossini had knew Bob through the FBI, and he also was involved with this actress at the time called Linda Fiorentino. And Mark Rossini eventually ends up in a lot of trouble because he is found to be leaking information to a private investigator, Anthony Pelicano. That was a pretty notorious case about 10 years ago. But as far as their direct involvement in this case, Rossini and Linda Fiorentino are sort of bit players. They're really not part of the main action of the case or of the story.
Let's move to the prisoner swap or hostage swap or whatever it's called that happened in January, I think it was, with the Iran nuclear deal. A number of prisoners were swapped. Bob Levinson was not among them. Why would that be?
Well, bear in mind that the Iranian government has never acknowledge that it has Bob Levinson, right? It's right. always said, we know nothing about him. That was from day one. We don't know who this guy is. We don't know what happened to him. We don't know where he went to, blah, 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 blah.
And it's the worst case scenario, of course.
Right.
There's that as well. But, right. you know, that would then also reinforce the idea where, you know, okay, if we've been holding someone who's no longer alive, we're certainly not going to admit to the fact that we were holding him, because then that raises the question of, well, what happened to him? And why didn't you keep him alive? And how did he die? And so on and so forth.
There's something else that you write about, which is pretty amazing, which is this. I sometimes think when I'm talking to you, Barry, that I'm talking to the private investigator, not the investigative reporter. I guess there's a fine line in this case between them. There's this private meeting in 2011 when the Iranian ambassador to France admits that Iran is holding Bob Levinson and that he's still alive. Tell us about that meeting.
Yeah, that was pretty stunning. And yes, sometimes I did feel like the private investigator. So basically, there is a religious organization. It's an evangelical Christian organization called the Fellowship Foundation. It's a very secretive and powerful group. They have a lot of lawmakers and businessmen and other folks who are involved with them. They have had a tradition of reaching out and being very active internationally. They were active in Iran. They had gone over to Iran in 2002, 2003 on a religious mission there, Douglas Cole, the leader of the fellowship. They had been helpful in getting an American scholar, Iranian-American scholar, released from prison in Iran in 2006, I believe it was. And this sort of Russian businessman with questionable past sort of approaches the fellowship and asks them to get involved in Bob's case. And they agree to do that on a humanitarian basis. So there's a meeting that happens in late 2011 in which the Iranian ambassador to France meets with two representatives of the fellowship. And at that meeting, which I was able to get all the notes and reports from, he acknowledges to them that Iran is in fact in control of Bob Levinson's destiny. And that if the U.S. wants Bob Levinson back, Iran is willing to make that happen, providing that the U.S. stops the publication of a United Nations report on Iran's nuclear capabilities. And that report was going to show that they were working to develop, you know, components of a nuclear weapon. So that was this kind of bold, obvious admission by a top Iranian diplomat. What was shocking to me is that the United States has never made this public. This has became public because I wrote about it earlier this year in the Times. It's in the book. They never told the Levinson family about it. Maybe this guy was not telling the truth. Maybe he was telling the truth. But that the United States government would not use that piece of information as a weapon to try to find out what happened to Bob Levinson, I consider an abdication of responsibility on the part of, you know, people like John Kerry or even President Obama. They had an obligation to use this information, and they chose not to.
What about Congress? There have been some rather empty congressional declarations, but what about investigations?
I feel the same way about Congress. I mean, you know, every year there's been a declaration by the United States Congress, by the Senate, House of Representatives, to Iran, tell us what you know, blah, 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 blah. It's a bunch of empty nonsense. The only thing that's going to make a difference if the United States Congress, the Senate, the House, puts the Obama administration to the wall and says, tell us everything you know about the involvement of Iranian officials in Bob Levinson's case. We don't know if you, we don't care if you know it for a fact, but what's the evidence that you have gathered over the last 8 years that points to the involvement of people like this Iranian ambassador or a former president of Iran or the son of the intelligence advisor to Ayatollah Khamenei? These are the people you want us to go forward and deal with in the years ahead. We have a right to know how they may be involved in this individual's capture and or death.
It seems like there are so many political implications here. It's
People don't want to mess with them. That's the problem.
Right. And especially now with the deal.
Exactly.
What do you think we should be doing? I mean, people, our listeners right now, the readers of your book, they have that Facebook page, you know, What About Bob? Which, you know, people can share. The family asks that we write to our senators and congressmen. What do you think that we should be doing?
If I was doing something right now, if I could do something, step out of my role as a journalist mm-hmm. and do something, but if I lived in South Florida, there are people like Congressman Deutsch and people like Senator Nelson who've expressed tremendous, you know, interest in this case. And Senator Nelson did some great things where this case is concerned. But they are the ones who should be, you know, the people in your community should be demanding that they find out what happened here. It's enough, you know, it's not enough to go to memorials every year for Bob Levinson. What they need to do, what they should be doing for his family as their constituents is bringing this case to a close, letting the American public know what the Obama administration knows about the involvement of top Iranian officials in Bob Levinson's situation.
Do you feel in your heart, first of all, do you feel in your heart that he's still alive?
I have hope he is still alive, but it's very hard to believe that he is still alive after all this time.
And do you think that the truth is ever going to emerge? I know you hope it does, but do you think it will?
Not unless there are people that sort of see this in the most simplest light, and that light is this. An American has suffered, an American may have died, and at the hands of a country that could care less. And unless we as civilians, as citizens, as voters, whomever, take a real interest and see it in that simple, clear light, this will never come out, but, you know, we have an obligation to close this chapter, to do right by this family. This family has suffered tremendously, and at the very least, what our government owes them is the truth.
And you hope that, are those the hopes you have for your book?
You know, one of the guiding lights for me in writing this book was hoping that, you know, I could add to that truth. I could provoke a discussion of this case, and that in that discussion, we would learn what happened to Bob and why he was abandoned. Yes.
Well, Barry Meyer is an award-winning journalist and author. He's a staff reporter for the New York Times. He's been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and he's a two-time winner of the prestigious George Polk Award. His reporting at the Times is concentrated on the intersection of business, medicine, and the public's health. He was the first journalist to shed a national spotlight on the abuse of OxyContin. He's written Missing Man, the American Spy Who Vanished in Iran. Barry, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It was really a great pleasure. Thank you for your time.
And thank you for your work.
And that wraps us up today. We hope you enjoyed it. Our producer, Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer, Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. As always, we have free audio archives available at our website, WLRN.org, and more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And that brings us to tomorrow and Topical Currents. I'll begin a short vacation, but Bonnie and Linda Gassenheimer present another of our popular restaurant roundabout call-in programs, some of the area's leading dining experts.
Have a good vacation, Joe.
Thank you. I'll miss you.
I'll miss you.
That's Topical Currents. Thanks for listening this afternoon. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.